Future-Proof Extra from News Talk.
Now, the Northern Ireland Science Festival is taking place this week and next week. It is a fantastic collection of events. It's one of those things that just sort of spread it up very quickly and just became this wonderful celebration of science in not just Belfast, but across the six counties of the north. NISciencefestival.com. You can find out all about the sort of events. And one of the speakers there is Professor Mark Miodovnik from University College London. And he's going to be talking about the plastic waste solution. He's a material scientist and he joins us now. Mark, welcome to the programme.
Hello.
This is an issue, obviously, that we are obsessing about. And I'm wondering, do we have a recent paper, a recent and accurate idea of the scale of the problem, something from the past 6 months or past year?
I think mostly we're still grappling with the scale of the problem. I mean, I think it's clear that it's across the whole globe. People keep finding plastics everywhere they look, especially microplastics. So there's more and more evidence that microplastics is in the food that we eat, especially the fish, and in the kind of deepest trenches of the ocean and even in the Antarctic. So I think, unfortunately, I think we're suddenly waking up to more and more data that says we've managed to get plastic pretty much everywhere on the planet.
Mm. And from a materials point of view, maybe you might take us through what plastics are and the types of plastics that exist. I mean, then we might talk about what we might do about them.
Yeah, well, I think it's worth remembering that plastics were a solution to an environmental problem. So at the end of the 19th century, the West was getting very rich, lots of middle-class people wanting hairbrushes and buttons and mirrors and glasses. And that doesn't seem, you know, these seem trivial items, but people were pretty, you know, they didn't have them and they wanted that sort of stuff. And that stuff was made from things like ivory and from tortoiseshell. So you can think of a tortoiseshell pair of glasses. Your listeners may be wearing glasses now. Look at the material they're made from. Those were made of shells before, and so that just involved killing millions of animals. And after a while, they thought this is bad. If everyone's going to have a pair of glasses and everyone's going to have a hairbrush and everyone's going to have a mirror and so on, there isn't going to be any animals left. So they decided to invent plastics, and plastics were a big hit.
Was there? There was something which was kind of horrified me as a story. That billiard balls around about that time were made of ivory, and you would only get two or three out of a tusk of an elephant. And like when you think about how many you need for just one set, it gives you an idea of the amount of massacre that was done to get this precious substance. Is there any truth to the suggestion that plastics was spurred on by looking to find a suitable, cheaper alternative to billiard balls?
Yes, that's right. I mean, there was a competition in America to find a synthetic equivalent to ivory with the same mechanical properties. And that was when celluloid was invented by Hyatt. And, it's disputed who invented it. But anyway, he's the one who got it off the ground commercially. And celluloid replaced billiard balls. And you're right. I mean, it seems a trivial example, but you know, all the other things I mentioned too seem trivial, mundane. But actually, when you add them all up, it did equate to millions of elephants being slaughtered. And so it was a great step forward creating celluloid, which then, of course, because it was thin and you could make it into thin strips that were transparent and add photographic ingredients to it, you could make the film. And that's the invention of the motion picture. So plastic comes along, solves an environmental problem, invents a whole new way of telling stories, which is celluloid, motion pictures. We call it a film, going to see a film now. What is that? It's a plastic film. That's what it means. So, you know, plastic's embedded in our culture. What we watch, TV, radio, all relied on plastic insulation for electricity. All electricity coming into your homes is relies on plastic. You get rid of that, you don't have any electricity, you don't have any water. You know, we should be incredibly grateful to this material. But the problem was that then people fell in love with it so much that they then started thinking, well, the industry started thinking, well, we want to sell even more of it. Let's sell stuff that is disposable. Let's sell stuff that isn't going to last 10 or 20 years. Let's start sell stuff that's going to last 10 seconds.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that what single use is the word of the year a couple of years ago. And when someone puts a name on something and you pause and you just look around, when we first fully became aware of this idea that, hey, wait a second, all this plastic we're putting, you know, wrapping fruit in, or we're individually wrapping mints for your after dinner pleasure. Like, when you stop for a second and go, that's plastic, that's a resource that was used for 3 seconds, and then it then just goes where? It does horrify you. And I think there is a huge amount of guilt and anxiety that people now have fully rearing up to this problem. So from a mechanical point of view, these are polymers, which are long chains of carbon atoms. And are they particularly strong, these bonds, because carbon is it's sort of an even numbered element?
It's more that the carbon-carbon bond. So you're right. It's long-chain carbon molecules, which you get them from oil mostly, and there's a whole set of chemical processes that give you these things called polymers, which are these repeated units of these carbon molecules. And so the backbone, that carbon, you know, you can think of it like spaghetti. You know, if you look down a microscope at the plastic items in your life, you'd see spaghetti-type structures, and those are the carbon long-chain molecules. But they aren't individually bonded to each other. In many plastics, they have very weak bonds between them, and that's what gives them their rather remarkable properties, because they are both lightweight because it's made of carbon, they are strong enough to do the job, but they're also tough, so they move and they flex, and those bonds slip past each other, and that's what gives the polythene bag, for instance, its toughness. If you compare that to a paper bag, you know, a paper bag, once it goes, it just rips, doesn't it? And everything falls on the floor. A plastic bag, you know, plastic bag sort of starts to deform, and you get notice of it before it goes bang. And those are all very useful properties.
When we think about, obviously, carbon is an abundant element. It's pretty much everywhere. When we think about that, and we think about these bonds that are formed as a result of processing oil and so on, is there some form of alchemy we can use to reorganize these plastic materials into sort of virgin materials again? Is all plastic recyclable? Because we don't recycle plastic bags, we don't recycle soft films, we don't recycle so much plastic.
Well, yeah, it's true. Polythene is very recyclable, and the reason we don't recycle it is not that it's not recyclable. It's a very simple polymer, and it is totally recyclable. But it's the fact that it's so spread out in our homes and in the country that to collect it all back together again, and you need a lot of it in one place before it makes it economically viable to recycle it. So it's actually an economic problem with polythene bags. But you're right that there are lots of other plastics in our lives, like, you know, the motherboard of your, if you take your mobile phone apart, you'll find there's loads of plastic in there. It's absolutely vital for its operation, but it's a different sort of plastic than polythene, and it's a sort of a so-called thermoset, and you cannot recycle that very easily. And there's lots of that in our lives in other ways. All, you know, all modern boats are made from it, small boats. And these plastics, there is a different technology where what you do is you take it apart molecule by molecule, And then you get back to oil, essentially. So you can chemically take them apart. It's called chemical recycling.
Right. Now, I presume that is not something we do because of either environmental or financial reasons. Because to be able to bring that back to raw material, that would be fantastic. We'd have a closed loop system. But presumably, it's either dirty or costly.
Well, there's two problems. One is, no one has invested in that tail. Well, hardly anyone has invested in that tail over the last 50 years. So it's rudimentary. It does exist. In fact, it exists in the UK and there's several plants up and running. But, you know, it's got to compete against the global production of plastic, which has been going for 50 years. And that is very efficient. And more than that, it gets a very cheap feedstock, which is crude oil. The crude oil price is the big problem. If crude oil doubled in price, then the chemical recyclers would all start making money, but right, they have to compete, right, economically to globally. And I think that's been the problem. But I have to say that over the last year, because of the public outcry, all of the big companies that I've met, and we've been talking to all of them, have started to heavily invest in this, because they can see that the public is not going to accept the future where we don't recycle either chemically or mechanically all of our plastic.
When we talk about the recycling that we do for the most part, you know, there's lots of rumours going around about what gets recycled and what doesn't get recycled. When we throw our bottles and our Tetra Paks and all that sort of stuff into the green bin, I know it's not. I know you're from the UK, but presumably it's a similar enough process. Does all of that? How do they separate all that out? How is that done in a way that gives us a sense of confidence that it's actually being reused? And what sort of level of recycling do we do with the everyday milk bottle, for example?
Well, milk bottles, which are made of high density polyethylene, so a similar thing to a plastic bag, but a higher density version, they are highly recycled. And I've been to the factories that do it. I've seen it happen. So I can say, you know, with confidence that they do get recycled.
Great.
The problem is, and so do poly PET bottles, which are drinks bottles, which are these clear ones. The problem has been that there isn't much money given to the local authorities to invest in those processes. So there's not much incentive for them to invest, and they have to invest in all of the local, you know, facilities like buses and, you know, roads. And so the economics has not made sense for them to have the most advanced facilities. And that's been a problem. And I think that now, I think as long as everyone agrees that we all need to maybe spend an extra 5p on every of these bottles, and that money should go to the local authorities to invest in this equipment, because all the technology exists. I've been to the factories. Mm. Getting up to 70-80% recycling for those things is not hard at all. It could happen in a couple of years.
Well, one of the things that really concerns me is not the consumer. I think if we asked, certainly in a country that's wealthy enough like Ireland comparatively, if we asked people, would you be willing to pay an extra 3 cents on your milk bottle to have it fully recycled in a clean facility? Most people would say, at this stage, understanding the plastic problem that we have, I'm sure most people would say yes. But the issue is, supermarkets and providers to those supermarkets make those judgment calls on our behalf, and they judge how much or little we want that trade-off of price. And I've seen this in action. I was at an IBEC conference and I saw a manufacturer who said, we proposed to do this slightly more recyclable plastic, and we were told by this large retail chain that people don't want to spend an extra 2 cents on their product. And that is what terrifies me. It's that people are making decisions based on the presumed lack of concern for the environment of the populace. And that, to me, is a huge issue.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I've had the same conversations and I've seen it in action. Talk to the brand and you say to them, okay, here's a shampoo bottle. Now, it's sort of purple and green and, you know, looks all sexy. And that's, of course, the brand. And they want, and you say to them, look, if you could make that one color and one plastic, that would increase its recyclability 100-fold, right? Because the colors are difficult and the different plastics together are difficult. It all makes it difficult. But one plastic, one color, now we're in business. They utterly, utterly do not want to do that.
Yeah.
And they say to us, the public doesn't want that either. They like their brands. They like to see this stuff in their bathroom. And I think we need as a public to push back on that and say to the brands, no, we're perfectly happy with all shampoos looking the same. They might have a paper label on the front.
Or a different shape.
Yeah, they can be a different shape. But I think we should just say, as a public, hello, brand owners, we want all our shampoo bottles to be made of the same polymer. We want all our milk bottles to be the same. And that is better for the environment. And it's actually better for the brands, because as long as there's a level playing field, they all know that they're all on the same playing field, they will do it. They did this in Japan, by the way. They basically banned all colored plastic for drinks bottles.
Really?
Because for the same reason. They just said everyone has to have transparent. And then they all did it, and 90% recycling. It's like that easy.
Ugh. And yet it hasn't been done in this country or many others, which is a totally different issue. Probably to do with lobbying, probably to do with marketing and advertising companies having invested a huge amount in understanding that relationship. So what about other more wild techniques in terms of fixing this plastic problem? Are there bacteria? Are there things that we could use on a large scale to basically turn this plastic back to something that isn't even that is biodegradable and disappears into the environment safely?
Yeah, so we've been doing a lot of work in that area. People will probably notice there's quite a few plastics coming into their lives that say biodegradable on them. They might even say home compostable on them. These are often membership magazines that have a sleeve on them. And the sleeve has your address on it, and it says, this is not a plastic. Sometimes it even says that, which is not true. It is a plastic. They're confused. Their marketing department are confused. It's a plastic, but it's a plastic in which bacteria, it's basically food for bacteria. So if you put it in the right conditions, the right humidity and the right temperature, then bacteria will eat it. The problem is that those conditions don't exist in very many places. So in the case of most biodegradable plastics, the ones you might get offered in a takeaway restaurant, so the knives and forks, they might say these are biodegradable. But the problem is they will only biodegrade in very specific conditions. And where do you put them once you've used them? You put them in the bin, but the bin goes to landfill, and the landfill has not got those conditions. They will still be there in 10 years' time, unfortunately. And if they end up in the sea, they'll still damage the wildlife in the same way that normal plastics do. So the problem, I think, with the biodegradables thing is it kind of appears to people often like a magic wand. Ah, we've made the situation go away.
Yes.
But it isn't at all. And what it's just shifting the problem one stage further down the road.
Totally. And when we look at manufacturers or coffee shops and so on, this switch to biodegradables has been this sort of almost disappearing of guilt, disappearing of responsibility. And you're right that unless that, and this is very important, people, unless that biodegradable cup goes in the brown composting bin, it has no chance of degrading in the way. But certainly, though, there are harder sort of plastic. You said knives and forks, and I've seen those are harder shells. Unless they are in that environment and they go through, is it an exothermic reaction or some sort of degrading in a proper commercial composting facility?
Yeah, it's an industrial composter that goes up to 60 degrees centigrade. And of course, at that temperature, a whole load of different bio reactions, well, not reactions, it's organisms essentially eating this
right,
stuff.
Right, okay. Shows how much I know about picking terms out of the air.
No, but it is a biological process, but it has to happen at a high temperature in the case of those ones. And if you don't have it at high temperature, this stuff will be around for decades. And that's the problem. I think people are... I do think there's an element of greenwash here. I think people are being missold a solution. Not all of them. And I think that's also the problem, that some people are trying their best to do the right thing. The home composting is interesting because we've got this – we're running an experiment called the Big Compost Experiment to see whether those home compostable plastics – so they say put them in your compost bin at home if you have one. Mm. We know that only probably 5% of people have one anyway. So if you're giving it to 100% of the population, that seems a little bit irresponsible to me. But of the 5% out there who do compost – everyone's compost is a different temperature and different, humidity. Yeah. So how do they know that they compost? And it turns out they don't. It turns out that we have to do this experiment. It's a citizen science experiment. People are really would love you all to join in, because if you go to the Big Compost Experiment, you can. And because we would like you to do the experiment, put them in your compost and tell us if they do decompose over a period of time.
Because the theoretical properties of a piece of plastic are of little use to the problems that we see when we talk about plastic in the oceans or in the environment, in our food. The theoretical properties make no sense. Unless it day-to-day works in a wide range of composting or so on, it's just not useful. But this idea that, that we can use... And I just want to say, because I'm not perfect, this morning I had a cup of coffee. It was in... I didn't have my keep cup because I'd forgotten to bring it out. And I put one in the black bin. And I know that it's going to landfill, and I felt awful about it. But, nobody is perfect. People, you do what you can. But being aware of these things and being able to make the right choice when you can is much preferable than thinking you're doing the right choice, but actually not doing anything and just adding to the problem without even being aware of it.
Yeah, I think we're in the kind of no, you've got a problem stage of our addiction to plastic. I think not everyone is yet like you. But I'm sure many of the listeners have this guilt about the fact they know they have a problem. And I think that's the first stage. But I think we shouldn't rush to a solution that will make it worse. And I think that's that's often happening as I see it.
Yeah. And actually, the coffee shops don't push the keep cups as much as they do. There's one in a South County Dub. There are a few, but Food Game is not far from the Aviva, and they really push this keep cup thing. And actually, that is obviously one of the most sustainable ways of having your coffee, is if you can remember to bring ideally a glass a keep cup. And that is one way of avoiding having all those sort of biodegradable coffee cups, which say they are, but they aren't.
Yeah, coffee is one of those things you can do something on a daily basis, because often people have a habit, they've got a habit, they go to work and they get a coffee in a certain cafe and then they go to their desk or whatever they do. And I think if you can break the habit of using a disposable by just thinking ahead and bringing a cup with you, you are definitely doing the world a favor, everyone a favor, wildlife, environment a favor. If you could, and I don't think it's a big sacrifice.
Yeah.
Turns out that actually only 15% of the population are prepared to do that. They're busy or they've got other things going on. But it would be great. But I don't think the future is going to be everyone carrying around a cup with us. We actually need a better solution to that. This is a stopgap solution, in my view. It's funny about the coffee, isn't it? We used to, I remember, you never got a cup, you never took a takeaway coffee. I mean, most cafes gave you a ceramic mug, and that's how it worked. And you sat down, you drank your coffee, and that was totally normal. And yeah. No one really, but we've now got to the point where coffee is this thing that you it's almost a right that you can take it away with you in a safe way with a top. And people, I don't think, are going to go back to only being allowed to have coffee in a cafe. I think that's true.
You're absolutely right. The biggest problem in behavioral change is fighting the convenience that plastics have brought us. Professor Mark Miodovnik from University College London, thanks very much.
Thank you.